want to do this because John needs to get out of here to another meeting.
Right.
Senator Morissette, are you here on 572?
No, he's not.
Okay. We're going to do 572 right now, and I'm taking 274 off for today, if anybody's here for 274. Just FYI. Yeah, I'm not doing 274.
Oh.
Is that what you're here for?
Yes. And my constituents who asked that there will be an emergency in your way. That's fine. Judge Sinclair.
Can she count to 16?
We won't know until we... It's been amended, and I think there's some misunderstanding with the bill.
Okay. Well, I promised Mr. Bolgio I'd get him out of here real quickly, so let me do him real fast, and then we'll do yours. Okay. Bill 572. Yeah. So, Philip Stallings, Lane County. Well, actually, why don't you explain what the bill does? And I should have the proponents. The proponents didn't sign up. Did you plan on speaking?
Can we send him?
Oh, I got two pages. Sorry. Okay. I'm sorry. Hang on, then. Yes, please. Oh, man, we got a lot of testimony here. Okay, why don't Mr. Ballou and Mr. Reed, why don't you come up? I think I'm going to let the two of you have a little discussion about this, and we're going to see if we're going to get anywhere.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 572 modifies the definition of the public practice of geology for the purpose of the statute relating to registered geologists so that it emphasizes that public practice must be for other persons for fee or other compensation. There are two amendments, a -1 and a -2 amendment presented. One, written as requested by Professor Mark Reed, containing language acceptable to him, and the other with changes to the definition of geology approved of by the board.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Reed, why don't you start, please, and also speak to your -1 amendments as well, and then, or if you and Mr. Ballou have worked out something, then let us know what you've worked out.
I think the two amendments probably express where we are right now, which is
okay. We've
worked out a lot, but not all.
Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Mark Reed. I'm a geologist at the University of Oregon and a resident of Lane County. Tara Corcoran and members of the committee, I speak in favor of Amendment Number 1 of the bill, which is the one that I proposed, and that's really the form that I'm going to be addressing today. The issue that the bill addresses is a problem in the existing state statute, wherein the definition of public practice of geology is vaguely worded, and it's been vaguely worded from the beginning, and it's been a problem for a long time. And as a consequence of the vague wording, at least in part as a consequence of that, the statute has been misinterpreted over the years, in part by the State Board of Geologists examiners, in such a way as to disallow free speech in public testimony by citizens of the state of Oregon. So the goal in the bill would be to revise the language so as to address that problem, that long-standing problem. My familiarity with this case stems from my own experience in testifying in a gravel pit hearing in Eugene, Oregon, in which I drew upon my experience both as a university professor specializing in mineral resources, and my history, I worked for 3 years for the Anaconda Company in Butte, Montana, a copper mining operation before coming to the University of Oregon, so my familiarity with mining stems from that. Based on that background, I addressed the Lane County Commissioners in relation to the gravel pit testimony in Eugene, and pointed out a number of serious errors in the geologic studies and misrepresentations of the geology as presented by the gravel pit geologists. And as I say, I felt an obligation to respond because of the errors that I found in what had been submitted into the public record. So I spoke in a public meeting before the county commissioners as a citizen speaking on my own behalf addressing this bill that was on the table before the county commission. As a consequence of my testimony, the gravel company filed a complaint against me with the State Board of Geologist Examiners, and the State Board pursued that complaint against me for some period of months up until their pursuit was challenged in a lawsuit that my lawyers brought on my behalf. And the argument at stake was a First Amendment free speech right. That is, that citizens have a right to speak to their government under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and under Sections 8 and 26 of Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution. Not only my case is one that I just outlined very briefly, where my free speech right had been abridged. There have been others in the past, in the 80s and in early 2000, in 2001. Now, the amended version of the bill that I've suggested here addresses the key points of concern. One is the definition of public practice of geology itself, emphasizing that public practice is for another person. That is, the language "for another" is in there now, whereas before that was not in there, and that was a source of some problem, the ambiguity in what the definition meant. The second key point in the amendment that we've suggested is that there be an added provision that's on page 2 of my written testimony that I've handed you there. It's under number 9, a person shall not be construed to publicly practice or to offer to publicly practice geology solely because the person testifies or prepares to testify in a public proceeding. Now, as far as I know, the language that I'm proposing resembles in substance, although not in word-for-word detail, much of the language suggested in Amendment Number 2 from the OSBGE, except for one very significant difference, and that's really the focus of the rest of what I have to say. That very significant difference is that in the version suggested in Amendment Number 2, this provision Number 9, the one I just read to you, has an additional modifier in it in which it would be such that a person who chooses to make public testimony may only testify on the person's own behalf. So the amendment number 2 adds that distinction, distinguishing testifying on one's own behalf from just plain testimony without any particular modifier. Now, I recognize that this was an issue in the discussions that we've had with the State Board of Geologist Examiners.
Mark, is that the only distinction between the two?
No. There are other differences in wording in 672-5057, although the meaning is, I think, the same in the two. I think, you know, there are differences in the wording there. There's also a difference in the wording in 672-5252. Now, I have not seen the detailed printing of Amendment Number 2, so I'm not exactly sure all of what is in that.
They look almost identical to me. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Okay. Well, there's a difference of the word "and" versus the word "or" in 5252, and the word "registered" is in or out in the two. As I say, I am, as far as I know, they're actually fairly similar, and I haven't actually had a chance to look carefully at that Amendment Number 2 myself. But the Number 9 provision is really the key point of significant difference. That is, as far as I know, the OSBG has agreed on the concept of "for another" in the definition, that is, 672-5057. and they've agreed on there being some kind of provision on public testimony. The key difference is whether that testimony is restricted to being on one's own behalf versus the possibility of a group asking a spokesperson for the group to speak on their behalf, and that spokesperson could be a geologist. Now, recognizing that there was this issue at stake, I asked Professor Garrett Epps, who's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Oregon, to help evaluate the First Amendment issues in these two versions. And Professor Epps' opinion is included in a separate stapled set of material that should have been distributed to you. And I'd like to just point out a few of the points that Professor Epps makes with respect to testimony before a public body. And first, I want to emphasize very clearly at the outset the category of speech that we're referring to is strictly and specifically testimony to a government body when that testimony is invited from the public by that government body, like a county commission seeking testimony on a land use proposal, for example. That's the specific free speech form that we're referring to here. And Garrett Epps's opinion is, I'd like to just mention or quote a few lines out of it that will help to illustrate the point. And again, Epps bases his opinion on review of constitutional principles and on case law, and he cites in his four-page opinion, which I've handed to you, he cites the specific case law in support of his contention. And one of the key points that Garrett Epps makes is the following. I'm on page 3 near the top of my testimony. The freedom of citizens to speak to government about their concerns in a public forum in which such comment has been invited is perhaps the single most strongly protected form of speech known to our system of free expression. He was addressing there, as I say, speech to one's elected representatives. Epps also makes a point of emphasizing Article 1, Section 26 of the Oregon Constitution, which addresses the point of petitioning one's government for redress of grievances, which exists in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but it has the added provision in the state of Oregon which says that that no law can restrain the inhabitants of the state from instructing their representatives. And that's the language from Article 26. So based on those things and the review of case law in Oregon and in the U.S. Court system, Epps concludes that when a citizen or group of citizens is invited by a government agency or body to comment on public policy proposals or individual analyses prepared by others and submitted as part of the public record, the central feature of this situation is that, one, the material is available to anyone for review and comment, and two, the agency or body has solicited comment from the general public. So that's a key point, that it's the general public. I just have a few more comments and then I'll conclude. Professor Epps also makes the following point. Again, based on case law, his review of case law, it is clear that no rule could restrict citizens, regardless of their training, from commenting on geological data in the record. It is further clear that no rule could forbid a group of citizens from seeking the help, advice, and public advocacy of another citizen, learned in geology, and from presenting testimony to the agency or body, regardless of that individual's training or lack thereof. So, those are the key constitutional issues and points that I think are really central to this discussion. And again, the difference between Amendment Number 1 and Number 2 pertains to whether, for example, a neighborhood group could ask a geologist who lives in the neighborhood to speak to the county commission on a land use proposal or whatever where geology pertains. And the contention of Professor Epps, based on the case law, is that the state cannot prevent an individual in that situation from public testimony. Now, finally, I'd like to say at least a few words about the issue of public safety.
Can we hold up?
Yes.
We're under terrible time constraints today with a lot of very large bills in front of us. I basically asked you and Mr. Ballou to work this thing out.
Right.
You have not yet seen the Dash 2 amendments?
I heard about it Friday of last week.
Okay.
And asked for a copy and haven't gotten one.
Okay. Well, I think I'm going to let Mr. Ballou is going to go on a little medical leave for a while. So I think what I'm going to do is let him make some comments about the Dash 2s, and then I'm going to leave it to you two to talk as Mr. Ballou's recuperating.
Right.
And see if we can get something out of here.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Ballou. I have a couple of ideas.
It doesn't have an O in front of it. I don't know what it means.
They're all over the place. Yeah. I once saw the definition of oleo once, and it's frightening. Anyway, I have four identities here. First of all, I'm the state geologist, so I see a lot of projects that require registration. I'm also certified engineering geologist number 8 for the state. I'm also on the board of geologist examiners. But in their wisdom, I'm an ex officio member and can't vote. And then finally, I am a former assistant professor of geology at the University of Oregon. So I can view this from a variety of different perspectives, and I'm fully aware of the difficulties, and I think the very difficult times that Dr. Reed went through in the last year, and I think it's very regrettable. When I heard about these bills, Senate Bill 572 and also the one on the House side, I was interested in them because the language of the bill did not track with what I thought the intent was. So I contacted the Chair Corcoran and indicated that there might be some confusion or some areas of disagreement. And through an exchange of emails, Chair Corcoran asked if I would assist in the kind of resolving of the issues. And I looked into it, and I made a couple of conclusions. We had a meeting with the Board of Geologist Examiners. We had a lot of people from the public. Mark Reed showed up. We talked. And I finally developed some conclusions, and I said that if the intent, let's cut through all the details, if the intent of this committee is to preserve the right of Mark Reed to testify on his own behalf at a public hearing, one could conclude he has that because the Board of Geologist Examiners rescinded the rules that caused the confusion in the first place. If the intent was to preserve it in somewhat of a realistic sense for other parties exactly the same, it is our legal counsel's advice that that is best provided for by application of constitutional law in the case in question on a case-by-case basis. Third option, if it's the intent of this committee or of the legislature to provide for the right of an individual to testify on his own behalf, as was the case of Dr. Reed, and to have clarity in the statutes into the future, then we would recommend Amendment 2, because it's a very narrow statement of that. And then finally, if it is the intent to go beyond this and talk about other cases on other people's behalf or other things, that is, in my mind, a very slippery slope that gets complicated in a hurry. It's probably best to leave that for discussion between the involved parties, either in a task force or in your interim. So we recommend, or I recommend, I guess, option 2, recognizing the differences of intent here, simply saying that if the intent is to get a bill out of here that preserves the rights with clarity of Mark Reed and others exactly like him, then option 2 does that. And I come to that conclusion based on some of my experience and some of the other things I think I know, or maybe things I think I don't know. Getting beyond that very narrow definition gets into areas where other people also will want to present eloquent arguments as from their point of view and their particular case, where they will have differences of opinion or problems that are not particularly or properly addressed by Dr. Epps of the University of Oregon. I don't have his language in front of me, but I do recall it says that nothing can be done to stop a person from commenting on the public record. It does not say anything specifically about adding substantively to the public record and then commenting. I'm not saying that that isn't a right. I'm saying I don't know if it's a right. And if the intent is to get into those additional concepts, then it's a long debate, perhaps should be had, with regard to a whole bunch of committees and commissions that regulate the activities of professions in the state. So I go back and say, with option 2, at least, we preserve the very core interests that have been expressed and have been the source of Mark Reed's personal problems and frustration and stress. And I say, I don't know if that's as far as people should go ultimately, but it's a realistic statement of what can be done now under these tight time frames. I would suggest also that if there are additional things that might be discussed, maybe the best approach is to direct the Board of Geologist Examiners during the interim to expand their agenda to address some of those and perhaps bring some more thoroughly thought out concepts to the next session. So with that, I'll close because I know you're in a pinch for time, and I appreciate your adjusting the agenda to accommodate my needs.
Sure. And I want you two to just continue working together and see if you can get somewhere with this. You know, that's probably what it's going to take to get the committee to support. What are you looking at? The amendments?
What is the difference between the dash one and the dash two? Somebody needs to show me this up.
They're very slight.
This is in the dash one, but not the dash two, line 8. And this is in the dash two, but not the dash one.
Okay.
Line 19 and 20.
Unbelievable.
I'm not quite sure what the distinction is, Mr. Chair, with inserting registered or not registered.
I think what we're going to do is we're going to let these fine gentlemen keep talking to each other, and then we'll bring this bill back before us. Mr. Bolio is going to be going under the knife, so he's going to be out of commission for a while. So,
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I can just state for the record, I agree with Mr. Reed. I don't think this is a practice area issue at all. I think his First Amendment, Article 1, Section 8, free speech rights were abridged by not being able to speak to a public body. The legislature provides for that kind of protection in ORS 171525 and 171530 when you testify before a legislative committee. It seems to me that rather than trying to redefine practice areas for geology, that we ought to maybe look at the issues of immunities and protections of individuals that testify in front of other public bodies. And I think we did to some degree on civil lawsuit issues. Last session there was a piece where there were frivolous lawsuits that were filed, and I don't have the exact reference, but we did so where there were lawsuits filed against members of the public just merely to get them to shut up. So I don't think this is a geology practice issue at all. I think it's a free speech issue. I think anybody that testifies in front of a public body should be afforded those rights. So that's my feeling about it. So when it comes back, I think I'd rather see us focusing on individuals' rights before public bodies, whether they're county bodies, water boards, or city councils, to the extent that we protected individuals before legislative bodies. So that's my 2 cents worth.
Okay, thank you.
Can we get that reference again on that?
171, what did I say?
525 and 530.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 572, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 741 for the purposes of referring this bill to a wonderful Judiciary Committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move the bill to Judiciary Committee.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 741 to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Any discussion?
Just one caveat.
One caveat, Senator.
The good senator from Eugene better not be carrying it on the House floor here coming up shortly.
Oh, that's right. There's a little competition going on now. Okay. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Close the work session on 741. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill, the one I wasn't going to hear, Senate Bill 274. Would you tell us what that does, Mark, please?
You weren't going to hear.
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 274 authorizes the suspension of state-issued licenses, certificates, or permits, or registrations for failure to pay monetary obligations to local government. There is an amendment to this that narrows the scope of this measure to authorize the suspension of state-issued driver's licenses by a circuit court, a municipal court, or a justice court for failure to pay a fine imposed by the court where the amount of the unpaid fine is more than $300.
Thank you. We have Senator Morissette, and we have Justice of the Peace Cynthia Sinclair. Welcome,
Thank
Justice.
You. Thank you.
This, we're going to try to do real quickly,
real quick.
Basically it's just to have a public hearing on it. There's tons of opposition to the bill.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's fine, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Bill Morissette, Senator from District 6, Springfield. This bill started out as a very ambitious bill that would affect any licensing at all in the state of Oregon. Scott Gallant was here because he was afraid it would affect his medical license of the doctors. It does not. It does not even affect the commercial driving license of people who drive a bus for a living or long-haul truckers. That's not in the first amendment or the Dash 1 amendments, but that will be added. I think this bill gets to a problem that Judge Sinclair and other judges have had, that there are no sanctions on people who don't pay fines. There's no way of forcing them to pay a fine. Now you might say, well, turn it over to a collection agency. That is minimally effective. I mean, it does help in some ways, but I think this bill does a great deal for the state of Oregon financially and certainly makes people responsible for their actions. So at that, I will turn it over to Judge Sinclair. But I think the opposition to this bill as originally printed is not there for the amended version. So with that,
it is. I verified that it is still there.
Okay. I would like to have Judge Sinclair have a chance to talk about it.
Thank you for hearing me. I'll try to speak fast. I know your agenda is really packed today. My name is Cynthia Sinclair, and I'm Justice of the Peace in Central Lane Justice Court in Lane County. I hear primarily traffic cases and small claim cases. Last year, we processed in my court 32,000-plus cases. I offered the following testimony on my own behalf. I don't speak for the other justices of the peace or judges of any court, the Judicial Department, or the State Court Administrator. What is currently left on this bill is that under ORS 809-410, it lists the conditions in which an Oregon driver's license may be suspended. They include murder, manslaughter, and homicide with a motor vehicle, reckless endangering with a motor vehicle, perjury to ODOT, driving a motor vehicle, hit and run, failure to file an accident report, driving uninsured, proof of insurance, drunk driving, and habitual offending. There are four suspensions that are reliant on an application. One is for truancy, in which a school district can ask the license to be suspended, one for a civil judgment in which the victim of a motor vehicle accident can ask for a license of the perpetrator to be suspended for non-payment of the judgment, one if we have outstanding traffic fines, that's mostly what I deal with, and then the other request is if the person is not paying their child support. SB 274 is currently configured to permit the courts to add non-payment of criminal fines to this list. I should note that I do not hear criminal fines, and passage of this bill will not benefit my court in any way. This should remove the taint of bias should that specter be raised. My court currently has outstanding judgments to it, owed to it, in the amount of $11,600,000 plus change. Of course, that amount varies from day to day. I'm a single practitioner in a justice court, a small fish, so to speak, in an ocean of courts. I have no idea what the actual dollar amount is that is owed to the circuit courts or the other justice courts, but I can imagine it's substantial. Assuming for the sake of argument that a quarter of the fine money that I take in belongs to the state of Oregon in the form of unitary assessments, medicals, state court security funds, and other fees, the state court is being ripped off of $3 million out of my court for deadbeats alone. If you count in the other 28 justice courts and 121 municipal courts and 36 circuit courts, the amount of money owed to the people of the state of Oregon is staggering. If our court system could collect on that mountain of money, many state programs would not be cut back or closed down. My proposal is we try to recover this money. The easiest, fastest, cheapest way, where there's a system already in place and where this could be accomplished, is through suspension of driver's privileges of deadbeat debtors. A driver's license is a privilege. It's granted by the largesse of the people of the state of Oregon, and the word here that's key is privilege. Criminals violate the law. They violate society's rules, people's individual rights. They destroy property and lives and so on. I don't know what the current conviction rate is nationally. I've heard as low as 17% and as high as 60%. Regardless, for those that we catch and actually manage to convict, we fine a great number of those people. Whether they pay that fine, that debt to society, seems to rest on their motivation to do so. Needless to say, there are huge amounts of unpaid fines out there waiting to be paid. SB 274 aims to give these deadbeat defendants some incentive to pay their fines. That incentive is retention of their privilege to operate on Oregon roads. The Department of Transportation already has the infrastructure to suspend licenses for some crimes and some unpaid fines. This bill would simply broaden the list of things for which suspension could be ordered. It would amount to almost no additional cost to ODOT. They're currently charging $75 every time they lift a suspension, so some revenue would be produced in processing the suspension. Additionally, ODOT is funded from the state of Oregon, and any revenue recaptured by the state would have a positive fiscal effect on the state and thereby ODOT. In these dire financial times, it should be incumbent on the state government to utilize every creative idea they can to recoup money that is owed to the state and the counties as well. The health of the court system is partially tied to monies provided by the state and counties, and that money is generated by payment of fines. I have to wonder if we'd be closing the courts one day a week if every one of the fines that we had owing to us was paid. I doubt we would. An added bonus to this legislation there would be an additional level of responsibility laid at the doorstep of criminals. A message should be sent to those people that privileges can be taken away as easily as they are granted, and that violation of other people's rights and properties has a cost that must be paid and cannot be ignored. Simply put, bad actions have consequences, and we, the people of the state of Oregon, will be insisting that those consequences flow to those who deserve them. This money is already owed to us. It's owed to the people of the state of Oregon. This bill allows you a means of retrieving what is already owed to us. It's wrong that worthy programs are being shut down and people are going without treatment and all the other cuts that are being made when criminals are allowed to get away without paying their fines. I'm asking you to support Senate Bill 274 so we can change that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Quick question.
Yes, Senator Minnis.
When do you turn on your unpaid fines over to collection now under current?
We give them probably about 6 weeks to pay it, and we send a suspension notice out. It takes DMV about 60 days to get that suspension going, and then we turn it over to collections. So it takes them a while, probably 3 months or so, before that actually goes into effect.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on 274, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2004A. And I'd like Mr. Hendricks, the vowel-impaired Mr. Hendricks, to come forward, please.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel, and the Chair's obviously been talking with Marla Ray, who is spreading around this vowel impaired business. How can I help you?
Would you explain to us what the dash 17s, 23s, and 24s do, please?
The dash A17 amendments are directed at which life expectancy tables you're going to use for different members of the system. Currently, there are different tables that are, of course, used on different ages because as you get older, your expectancy changes. But in general, and there aren't any categories between people as far as life expectancy tables. Once long ago, we had different tables based on whether you were male or female. There was a consent decree signed because of a lawsuit back, I believe, in the late 70s, and PERS abandoned that practice. The dash A17 directs the board to conduct a study to see if there's a difference between the life expectancy of a regular member as opposed to a police and fire officer member, and then indicates that if the board does determine that there is a significant difference between the categories of regular employees and police and fire employees, that the board will use separate actuarial equivalency factor tables for police officers and other members of the system.
Oh, this is your bill. Okay. Mark, does everybody have copies of the 17s, 23s, and 24s?
I do. I don't have them of the 23s and 24s.
Okay. Hold on just a moment, please, till we get that. Senator Starr.
Here's a 24. That's right there.
Yeah, we could just get some copies made.
I have all of them.
You have all of them?
17, 23, and 24.
We're all set then. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Dave. So basically, this calls for the study on the police and fire.
That's correct. Indicates that if, in fact, they find a substantial difference, that they will use separate tables starting as of January 1st, 2005.
Okay, do I hear a motion to move the 17s?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 17 amendment.
Senator Menace moves the Dash 17 amendments into House Bill 2004A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Dash 23s, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the memo that you that accompanied the Dash 23s.
Chair Corcoran, the Dash A23 amendments would replace the portion of the bill that currently has the expedited review to the Supreme Court. There were earlier amendments that would have made judicial review under Section 5 of the bill the exclusive way in which it could challenge whether or not the implementation of mortality tables under the bill, that you had to go the route that was spelled out in Section 5 and you had to file a petition before August 15, 2003. The two attorneys, the attorney representing the First Coalition and the attorney representing the local governments, had worked together, and this was their consensus amendments. I had wanted to note that some of the language that was removed was language that was designed to make it very clear that this was not the exclusive remedy that was available. On the other hand, the language doesn't have language indicating that exclusive jurisdiction is conferred on the Supreme Court to decide this issue. I'm assuming that the intent here is that this not be the exclusive remedy, but I was a little concerned that perhaps there might be some argument because of the removal of the language that, in fact, this was the only way in which you could challenge it. I, of course, don't care. It would be good if it was as clear as possible, though, one way or the other.
Senator Menace? Well, Mr. Hendricks, as I'm reading this, it says jurisdiction is conferred on the Supreme Court in subsection 2, section 5, in the amendment, it says that the... A person aggrieved by the implementation of actuarial equivalency tables under Section 2 and 4 of the 2003 Act may petition the Supreme Court for relief. It also implies that they may go to the Court of Appeals if they choose. Am I reading that correctly? Because it's a may.
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menace, that's correct. Okay. Although that could also be just to read indicating that you have the option of doing it. Mm-hmm. The real concern is whether or not... if by failing to do it, of course, that you waive all rights thereafter to challenge it under the bill. This is very similar language to one of our permanent laws that deal with expedited review of initiatives and referendums. And one of the reasons why I get a little concerned is that there were arguments made before the Supreme Court about whether or not that law was intended to be exclusive or not. Mm-hmm. And our preference always is that the bill be as clear as possible on those sort of issues so people don't end up litigating over it at a later time.
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, Mr. Hendricks,
explain to me then, subsection 3 says the person petitioning for relief under this section is not required to exhaust administrative remedies or file in any other court. Again, by application, you can file another court. But you're suggesting by not doing anything, they may lose their right to do this.
Subsection 3 is to make it clear that this is, in fact, direct review to the Supreme Court and that any other law that might be out there, such as the laws relating to appeals to the Court of Appeals, or even through PERS. PERS has administrative review provisions as well. Mm-hmm. To make it clear, you don't have to jump through those hoops before you go to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
Questions, colleagues?
Okay. Nope.
Chair, entertain a motion to move dash
23 amendments.
Senator Menas moves dash 23 amendments into House Bill 2004A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. How about the A24s?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, the dash A24 amendments amends one of the existing laws and PERS, one of the, probably, I think the only one that really talks about the board's duties with respect to establishing actuarial equivalencies. There are several places in the chapter, in Chapter 238, that indicates that, for instance, one form of retirement benefit has to be the actuarial equivalent of another. The language that's amended in the dash A24 amendments would make it clear that in performing its duties, the board's duties in determining actual equivalency of optional forms of retirement allowances, that in fact they're going to be using the actual equivalency factor tables adopted in the manner provided by this act to make it clear that Section 2 is the governing rule with respect to how you go about setting actual equivalency factor tables for all of the laws underneath the ORS Chapter 238.
Thank you. Do I hear a motion?
I move the adoption of the A24 amendment.
Senator Menas moves adoption of the A24 amendments to House Bill 2004A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Do I hear a motion to move the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2004A engrossed as amended by this committee to the floor of the Senate.
Senator Menas moves House Bill 2004A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes.
Senator Walker?
I just want to be sure because we've had a number of amendments. The only three amendments to this bill are the ones we just passed today.
16 we also did. 16. Yay, 16s were the ones we did first.
Okay.
And all the other amendments were done in the House. We're much more efficient than the House.
Okay.
We only needed
more
eight. Yeah. More contemplative. That's right. That's what it is.
16 was the look back.
Correct.
Okay.
The look back applying to all the other provisions and not just option zero.
Okay.
I'm looking at the nodding heads out there. So, does that answer your question?
Do you have a
question?
Yes, I'm sure.
Question I have is, with the amendments that we've adopted, what is the interplay now as it relates to Lipscomb? Are we in any way affecting, what's that relationship with this bill in its current form, signed by the governor? What happens if Lipscomb is either upheld or overturned? Anything?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator.
Because I raised that issue a number of different times. I spoke with Mr. Hendricks about my concern. One of the issues that he pointed out to me was is that the amendments that we've just adopted in the 20-24 and Lipscomb, this bill, actually rise and fall on the same question, and that is whether or not the board can implement new actuarial tables. So the A24 amendments were really crafted to try to make it clear that the board, in fact, must, that they shall, that they cannot just sidestep the issue, but it is a legislative command that every 2 years when they review these things, that they will implement them. Because the old language had language in it from time to time,
right.
Slippery slope language, et cetera, et cetera. So I was satisfied after speaking with Mr. Hendricks that rather than creating a very difficult, complex legal question for the attorneys, that this would be, in essence, a legislative fix, and should this be subject to the suit, as is the Lipscomb case, they both rise and fall on the same issue, and we'll have an answer to that question at some point or the other. That the benefit, I suppose, of this 2004 is that we now have an interceding legislative fix that hopefully the court will look on favorably as they're reviewing the entire plethora of issues raised with these cases, actually all of these different cases will be filed. So I think it's a reasonable settlement at this point. It does make it clear that the board shall implement it, cannot just ignore their duties. I wish we could implement something more serious, but we may not be able to get anybody to be a board member.
And were we actually to have adopted the language in 19, we may have
created another level of suits that would follow down from a remand back to Lipscomb, who would then order the board to take action. The last action the board contemplated was a look back with interest, which didn't really have the same savings as this. So in some respects, I think this kind of settles the Lipscomb hash in and of itself.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other discussion? Seeing none, would you call the roll, please, Ms. Gravel?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bennett?
Aye.
Senator Corker?
Aye. House Bill 2004 is amended, is going to the floor, and I think maybe you're carrying 2005. I'll carry this one.
Okay.
Unless you want to carry this one.
Starr is carrying
2005. Oh, Starr's carrying 2005. I'm sorry. Do you want to carry
this? I think you can carry this one because you like to talk a lot on the floor. But I'll join in if I need to.
Well, you can.
I just want to make sure that the legislative intent is clear on the floor with respect to the board, and I would hope that you would include those in your comments as the carrier of the bill. So,
Senator Menace and I will both carry this bill. Close the work session on 2004. Thank you. Okay. Let's do some collective. Well, let's see what we have here. Let's do the collective bargaining bills, please. So I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 444. Mark, you want to remind us what this bill does?
We also have to move
right.
By correction.
Okay. And we'll just bring up the interested parties in this.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, these three bills modify the criteria used by arbitrators in public collective bargaining. They have amendments to each of them that narrows criteria for the comparison of wages and hours to areas located in the West Coast. Those were Dash 1 amendments that have now been rolled into the Dash 2 amendment, which adds back language of the original bill, which was omitted in drafting, which deals with recruitment and retention, allowing those provisions to be used as a criteria by an arbitrator. Senate Bill 445.
Let's say we're just doing 444 right now.
Oh, okay.
We're just a work session on 444. And we have an amendment, and the amendment is from Department of Corrections? No.
No. We have a Dash 2 amendment.
Okay, why don't you come up then, Mr. Livingston, and let us know what we're doing here, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Councils. I believe that the committee administrator explained the Dash 2 amendments. In the original drafting of Senate Bill 444, there was an omission with respect to criteria that should have stayed in the bill that has to do with recruitment and retention of employees when an arbiter is to look at the criteria. And simply the Dash 2s incorporate that language back into the bill, as well as incorporate the Dash 1s that dealt with the West Coast of the United States. That's all it does.
Okay, I see no.
How did you change that?
No witnesses. So, shall we move the amendment and move the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I just had a question before we do that.
Okay.
Seems to me that someone had an issue with regard to that designation of the West Coast of the United States. I don't know if it was this bill or the next one, but I remember that discussion. Do you remember that discussion, Mr. Livingston?
I don't believe that's this bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, you're going to have to. I did not address that concern, and I can't recall if there was an individual that did that or not.
I don't see it in these notes that I have.
I believe it's in this bill. I think it's in 445.
Oh, here we go. Here we go. Who was testifying? Somebody from the Oregon Corrections employees, Gary, someone, said that arbitrators have difficulty in knowing what interest is. He says, can you elaborate on definition of West Coast? So that was the issue. Can you elaborate on the definition of West Coast?
For the record, Brian DeLeichmann, representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. The dash two, with the dash two amendments, the AOCE is fine on the bill. And Gary was speaking on behalf of the AOCE.
Okay. So he's... All right. I don't know why that stuck in my head, but I remember it was a question. All right. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 444.
Senator Walker moves the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 444.
But I've got a question.
Senator Minnis?
On the CPI issue, another question was raised with respect to average consumer price index, and there was some discussion about several different indexes. What was the resolution to that?
Mr. Chair,
it's because there's about six different CPIs. There's CPIW, CPIUs, and then there's the regional CPI. And I think that was the purpose. There's not one CPI all cities index.
So the language in the bill on line 32, I assume, is staying there. And what does that mean?
It means that CPA, it's one of the criteria.
I understand it's a criteria, but I guess I'm trying to figure out the average consumer prices for goods and services. Is there a place that that's determined or it's drawn from, or do we know?
I would suggest that both parties would present to an arbitrator what their view of the correct CPI to use would be, and the arbitrator would have the latitude to select a specific CPI.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, if I can try to help you with that, I think what that had to do with, if Mr. Tedesco, if I recall his testimony on that, is that was one of those kind of issues that through the genesis of arbitrations, it's been kind of ambiguous with respect to that, because not necessarily CPI All Cities Index applies to what the intent is to address that issue of coal. And as an example, there's CPI Portland, and this would just simply allow, for example...
So is it currently in negotiations the case that you have one party suggesting the CPI is X, the other party suggesting it's Y based on their analysis of different indexes, or...
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I can't honestly answer that question for you because I don't have the specific knowledge with respect to that.
And is that our intent? Is our intent that the parties would argue the CPI based on the various indexes available?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think the intent behind this is to allow them to do that so that it allows for average consumer prices for goods and services known as the cost of living, which is simply CPI, but not giving it to where it's the CPI All Cities Index, so that there is a little bit of flexibility for the parties, whether it's CPI Portland or CPI West.
Right. So this becomes then an issue submitted to the arbiter, assuming it becomes an arbiter's issue. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that's my understanding.
They're going to decide. One party could actually have a different view of the CPI, if I'm reading this correctly.
That's correct.
All right.
And arbitrators, these now under 750, the arbitrator can't pick and choose, right? I mean, they have to take
one or the other.
That's last offer.
Right. That's not being changed by this.
No. As much as we'd want to. That's right. So, we have moved the amendment. Have we moved the amendment?
Yes,
no.
I moved the amendment, Mr.
Chair.
Motion's before us to move the amendment. Any further discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 444 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 444 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Ms. Gravel, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Sayer?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye.
Senator Walker obviously out-manipulated you on this one and made all the motions to move this, so it would be hardly gentlemanly of us to not let her carry the bill.
I'm sure.
But I will give you other opportunities, Senator Starr.
Sure.
Senator Walker will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 444. Open the work session on Senate Bill 445.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
Not that I want to raise a stink here, but Senator Starr is a sponsor of the bill.
Of 444?
Well, my heart would tend towards allowing Senator Starr to carry it, but there, I don't want to get in the middle of this competition, frankly. And Senator Starr isn't nearly as mean as Senator Walker, so I had to take that into account as well.
She's in your caucus.
Careful.
But it's an open caucus.
Only if you have press pass.
That's right. All right. Senate Bill 445, would you review that one for us? Mark?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 445 modifies the definition of supervisory employee for the purpose of public employees' collective bargaining. We have a dash one amendment before us which exempts employees of the Department of Corrections from being included under this definition. And we've been handed a dash two amendment recently, which we will need someone to come speak to.
Okay, we have Chris Kotz and Mary Botkin, please. Why don't you both come up? I think you've got consensus on this.
I love that word. This time of year.
We're all about that concession.
Kumbaya.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Chris Kautz from the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I do owe Mr. Ellsworth an apology for some miscommunication on my end in getting the dash two amendments to him. If you'll recall, the last time we were here in discussing Senate Bill 445, the Department of Corrections did raise concerns because of what we think might happen to our management structure if the bill were to go forward as initially proposed. So we had requested the dash one amendments, which would have just taken the Department of Corrections out of the bill. However, concerns were raised by the labor representatives that the Department of Corrections, well, actually the language itself, speaking to the Department of Corrections, would still allow us to potentially reach in and classify currently represented employees as supervisory and move them to management service. Those that are represented now are correctional officers, corporals, and sergeants. So in our testimony the last time when we were here, you asked us to go back and do some work to see if we couldn't come up with a dash different set of amendments that addressed the concern of protecting the reach-in, the potential reach-in by the department, which of course is not our intent, but we understand how the language left that open, and come back to you with those amendments. And that's what these dash twos we believe do, which it still takes out the Department of Corrections, but says that it's not just the definition that would allow us to move them to supervisory status, but that we have to trigger a look at the collective bargaining agreements that we have at hand before we can just move people around from represented to management service, as I understand the amendments. This language is similar to what was in Senate Bill to pre-Senate Bill 750 statutes under the supervisory definition. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions, Chris?
No.
Ms. Botkin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. The Department of Corrections folks and us have worked together to come up with these amendments. We actually went to our counsel, Monica Smith, and had her work directly with Legislative Council on the language changes, and we're fine with this.
Chairman, I move the dash two amendments.
Senator Menace, move the dash two amendments. Senate Bill 445. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? So ordered.
Chairman, I move Senate Bill 445 as amended before the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Menace, move Senate Bill 445 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Walker?
Yes, I was reviewing the testimony from before from Mr. Livingston, and he said that he needed the dash one amendments. Did we pass those already? Or the dash one is now in the dash two. All right.
So everybody's taken care of then.
Good.
Okay, great. Ms. Gravel, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bennett?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. Senate Bill 445 moves to the floor. Senator Starr is a co-sponsor. Senator Starr will carry this bill, and you and I will stay out of this fight. Closed. All right.
Even though I'm the chief sponsor.
Are you the chief sponsor?
Okay, Senator Starr can carry it.
He's not in the room.
So oh, you are the chief sponsor.
Do some work.
Maybe just we should have Representative Barker carry it. No, you carry it. You should carry it. You're the chief sponsor.
Chair, whatever you say.
Well, I'm trying to keep these two happy in their competition.
Let Senator Starr carry it.
But Senator Starr's not in the room. Now he's going to have to do some research.
You don't need to be lobbying against Senator Starr just because he's not in the room, Senator Walker.
I move we suspend the rules to allow Senator Starr to vote.
I move, Senator Menace moves, do we reopen the hearing?
Suspend the rules.
Suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Senator Starr to vote on Senate Bill 445. So, no objection. We will reopen the work session on Senate Bill 445. Senator Starr, how do you vote?
Let's act.
Starr votes aye. You still don't get to carry it.
No, he can carry it.
Okay, you get to carry this one. Senator Starr will carry this. Thanks to the
good. He gets in trouble all the
time. Thanks to the good vice chair. Okay, we will now open a work session on Senate Bill 446. Mark, would you review that one for us, please?
I don't know.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 446 modifies the definition of employee relations to include certain staffing levels and safety issues for certain employees who are prohibited from striking. We have a dash one amendment associated with this measure, which clarifies that only safety and staffing needs are mandatory subjects of bargaining and not the others listed in subsection F.
Okay. And you said that we have dash one amendments. Mm-hmm. Okay, I've got it here. Here's the dash ones. Who's the author of the dash ones? Come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. In the drafting of this bill, the dash ones simply take away any confusion with respect to the intent behind this bill. If you follow the bill on page two of it, there's the potential that there could be an argument made that public safety members could have the ability to have as mandatory subjects of bargaining such issues such as gum chewing, reasonable duress, and that wasn't the intent behind this piece of legislation. And so the dash ones simply codify that what we're talking about is only those issues that deal directly with safety and staffing levels are mandatory subjects.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion? Any questions? Seeing none, can I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 446.
Senator Walker moves dash one amendments to Senate Bill 446. Any discussion? Yes, Senator Minister.
I want to let you know I'm going to vote no on this bill.
Okay.
It's not that I don't agree in principle with what they're trying to do. I just don't think that it should be part of collective bargaining. Particular equipment that is on its surface necessary. So at this time I'm going to vote no. I'll reserve the right to change my vote on the floor, but okay. I just don't agree that I think this expands collective bargaining, the scope of the collective bargaining for issues and items that I think should be provided without having to go to collective bargaining, if I can say.
That's a good point.
I just think some of these things are a no-brainer and some departments aren't providing it. I had a bill somewhere, but I lost it. I don't know what happened to the silly thing, but it may not have come out of legislative council.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Okay, so noted. Ms. Gravel, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bennett?
No.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. Is that to move the amendments?
Yes.
Okay.
The dash one.
And so now, Senator Walker, Senator Starr?
Yeah.
You would like to move the amended bill, Senate Bill 446. Senator Walker and Senator Starr have demanded that this bill be moved with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion? Seeing none, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bennett?
No.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. Thank you very much. So ordered.
Thank you, Tom.
No, you obviously can't carry it, so I've given them one apiece.
Hey, you're back to the Republican plan.
Heads or tails, Senator Walker?
Heads.
Tails it is.
Oh.
Senator Starr will carry. Okay, now, let's get into some really fun stuff and go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 763.
Okay.
Mark, would you like to tell the nice people what this bill does?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 763 requires metropolitan service districts to conduct analysis of subregional housing needs. It allows a district to expand the urban growth boundary based upon subregional needs. We have a dash one amendment, which copies are located in the back, and I have copies for members of the committee.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
This is my bill.
Oh.
And I'll speak briefly to it. I don't see the major testifiers in the room yet. They're all out looking in the hall at these amendments that everybody just got at the last minute.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And the amendments replace the bill. What we're talking about in this bill is not about throwing land use system out the window. It's not about trashing Senate Bill 100. It's not about bypassing a very complex land use system. What this really is about local communities who follow all the rules, having the needs in their communities subjugated to other communities that happen to be in the same urban growth boundary, but maybe you're 30 miles away. And what we're talking primarily about is the subregional analysis of housing and industrial and commercial lands. It would not be unlike, say, and I'll use Cottage Grove, for instance, as an example. Cottage Grove going through a process to expand its urban growth boundary and following all the rules laid out by BLCD, running through it all. And at the end of the day, they make the argument that their urban growth boundary should be expanded to accommodate housing needs. And that in order to accommodate the housing needs in Cottage Grove, Eugene's urban growth boundary got expanded so that they could accommodate the housing needs in Cottage Grove. And you could reverse it basically and say Eugene went through the same process, followed all the rules, all the requirements laid out in statute and rule, and Eugene made the argument that they needed the urban growth boundary expanded for industrial lands, and that expansion took place in, pick a community that's within 35 miles of Eugene, and that's where the expansion takes place. That's not unlike what happens in the Portland metropolitan area when Metro goes through a process of looking at urban growth boundary expansion. The needs in those local communities, I think there are 23 local communities in the Metro boundary, get subjugated to so-called the overall region. And so the expansion of our urban growth boundary metropolitan area, and we've gone through one, but it doesn't necessarily recognize those sub-regional needs that occur in communities within the urban growth boundary in the metropolitan area. It just so happens that a couple of communities in my district are most, maybe most isn't the right word, but are heavily affected by this. And I look at two communities of Forest Grove and Cornelius in particular that really have a need for industrial and commercial land, and yet they can't seem to get on the radar screen, so to speak. We have a lot of industrial land now located and brought into the urban growth boundary in Gresham. We have a lot of land available for residential development in Damascus. We got a lot of jobs in Washington County, and there's this problem about how this process works. Now, the Metro has applied to LCDC for a rule to accommodate the subregional analysis, and the rule was granted by LCDC, I believe in October of last year. What the -1 amendments is really just a copy of the rule, codification of the rule. You could argue that since, and the rule is currently on appeal. I believe it's been appealed by Thousand Friends, City of Portland, and City of Lake Oswego or Westland. I think Lake Oswego. And appealed on a variety of things, and I would bet that Thousand Friends at least is here to testify as to why they oppose the rule. But what this does is it codifies that LCDC rule, provides for the sub-regional analysis to be law. And so it's a process that I think we should recognize the role and responsibility of local jurisdictions who are following all the rules and yet have the priorities of that local jurisdiction overruled by kind of the overall larger region in this process. So with that, I guess we can have testifiers. I'd hope to have folks here from Hillsborough and Forest Grove, and I don't see them here.
So, Senator Stark, could you explain one thing to me then? So you identified Cornelius and Forest Grove as two communities that, because of the decisions made by Metro, were disadvantaged in their own plan to expand their particular urban growth boundaries for industrial land?
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay.
There was, I think, Forest Grove that actually wanted to do a land swap. They had land that was inside. It was zoned industrial, but it really wasn't usable industrial land. They wanted to swap that for some land adjacent to the boundary, equal acres, and they weren't permitted to do that. And Cornelius is a bedroom community of Hillsborough or Beaverton that's got a lot of residential, not a lot of commercial. They don't have a tax base to support general government services, and they would be benefited in large ways by expansion of their boundary for commercial and industrial to grow their tax base. But they get rolled into all these other communities.
Well, maybe we have to reconstitute Metro so that each city has a vote regardless of population.
How do they do it now, proportionality?
Well, I'm just saying, if you reconstitute it so each city has a representative, then each city's entity is represented. You don't have the big guys running over the small guys.
Like the Lane Council does.
My small cities have problems with our big sister to the west of us from time to time.
So you're on this bill. You're liking this bill.
Well, I do have a question of Senator Starr is whether or not this would affect the spring water project.
Not currently. I mean, it's already in. It's done. It's a done deal. Neither would it impact the Damascus expansion. But, you know, looking forward, I think that, you know, it's a recognition. I think the example of Cottage Grove or Eugene going through all, following all this process, and then LCDC saying, okay, you can expand, but you have to expand, you know, in a community that's 20 miles away. You know, that's the kind of logic that I see here, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it really creates serious transportation problems. When you're looking at trying to move people from one part of the region to another, when you have this unequal jobs housing balance, which causes a problem. And now Metro tries to, you know, do what they can to take care of those problems, but there's not enough money, quite frankly, to fund all that infrastructure need. So, anyway, I appreciate the opportunity for the bill to be scheduled for a public hearing. You know, I don't know that if you're looking for a compromise that gets everybody, you know, that's affected in the room, all to agree, I'm not sure you could get there. You know, and if there's a willingness on this committee to look at the issue and work the issue, I'd be obviously welcome that opportunity. You know, if we're not going. If the requirement is to kind of get everybody off singing on the same page, I doubt that's probably possible, but we certainly could try. So appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. I'd like to have Doug Riggs from Metro come up, please.
I signed on to a bill that would have repealed Metro back in the 80s.
There's one
I
on
think
the House
you did. Right.
Is there? I'm sure Rod Park wouldn't appreciate that.
That's right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I had a conversation with Senator Starr earlier, and I want to make sure that I am giving testimony that reflects both the underlying bill as well as the Dash 1 amendment, which I really haven't had a chance to take a look at. For the record, my name is Doug Riggs with PacWest Communications here representing Metro. And I want to start out right at the beginning by saying that we certainly do appreciate the Senator's interest in this bill. We've had a discussion, or several discussions, I think, with Senator Starr on this issue. As he knows, and as some of you on the committee might know, this issue came up in the Metropolitan Policy Advisory Committee at least a year and a half ago. Senator Menas, MPAC is the group on which all 23 cities, and there are 24 cities and three counties, sit, and it's not the voting is not weighted by population, but it's a single vote. In fact, Hillsborough is currently the chairman of MPAC, so we think that there's a pretty good balance on MPAC. A year and a half ago, we had a request from Washington County to ask LCDC for permission to use subregional analysis on primarily industrial lands, but also on housing needs as well. At first, when the discussion began, we thought that it might be necessary to actually say that Metro had the authority to do subregional analysis. And as we looked further into the situation, we found that actually we believe that under statute we do have subregional authority. So the question wasn't whether we had the authority, it was, you know, what were the rules, what was the roadmap to allow us to implement subregional on a case-by-case basis. And as a result, we asked MPAC to work with us to come up with a recommendation that we intended to send to LCDC. And as Senator Starr correctly mentioned, we did send a request to LCDC last year. It was initially approved by DLCD. It was approved after that point in time by LCDC, and it is currently under appeal. Three parties have appealed the rule, and we feel very confident that the appeal will be overturned and that the rule will be implemented here fairly shortly. Two of the three parties, the City of Portland and Thousand Friends of Oregon, have appealed the rule on only one of its multiple elements. And again, we feel very comfortable. Westlands appealed the whole thing. We don't think that either any of those three appeals will be upheld. So we have confidence that we will have subregional authority and a roadmap to be able to implement it. To the bill as written, I think we had four concerns with the bill. And as I said, I haven't had a chance to take a look at the Dash 1 amendments. And I want to be very fair to Senator Starr about that. I guess I'd summarize our concerns with the bill as written in 2 points. The first point is that we have the Metropolitan Policy Advisory Committee, which has worked very diligently over the last year and a half to come up with a system that works for the region. And we believe that the rule that LCDC approved would allow us to implement it. I think the major difference between the bill as written and the MPAC decision was that subregional, under our proposal, would not be required in each and every case. Subregional would be an option that Metro could pursue based on the advice that we got from MPAC. And if it made sense in a particular case or a series of cases, we could pursue subregional. And we fully intend to use subregional on our analysis of industrial needs, which we're currently conducting, which we expect to be completed by June of 2004. So I guess my number one point is, the system that we have, which we think will be upheld by the courts, is a system that will work, and I would prefer to come back in 2 or 3 years or a couple sessions and be able to point out how that did not work before we passed a bill here in Salem that would address that. The other issue is something that I think is addressed by the Dash 1s, but as I said, I haven't had a real chance to take a good look at it, and that was that the underlying bill only addressed the housing need and did not address the industrial need. And from our perspective, if you look at Washington County, the problem that Metro's had in expanding the UGB has been that Washington County is surrounded by prime farmland. And so in order to expand on to additional amounts of prime farmland, you have to have a subregional analysis to be able to justify that expansion. And we think that what LCDC has approved is going to give us the authority to consider sites on a case-by-case basis. I will note that for those of you who don't know, that Metro recently completed our urban growth boundary expansion. We've added 18,000 plus acres to UGB. Approximately 13,000 of those acres are for housing. Approximately 5,000 acres are for industrial purposes. That leaves us with a shortage, and no one disagrees with that fact. We are short industrial lands in Washington County. We've acknowledged that. We've testified to that point on the record, and we fully intend to rectify that using subregional analysis. So, again, I don't want to take a position on the dash ones because I haven't seen them. It has been explained to me that the dash ones simply implement the LCDC rule. My initial quick reading 2 minutes ago is that there seem to be some differences between what I remember from the rule and this bill, but I'd like the opportunity to take a further look at it and get back to the committee at a certain point in time. Thanks.
Sorry.
Well, what I think I heard you say was you want to do this later.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, I guess my bottom line point is we Metro acknowledged that there was an issue that could be addressed, and we acknowledged that there was a tool that we could have in our toolkit that might help us better address the needs of individual regions throughout the metropolitan area. Subregional is one of those tools, and we believe that we have the authority, or will shortly have the authority, to pursue what this bill intends to have us do.
Right, which gets to my point. Why would you want to clarify it now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menace, I don't have any problem clarifying it. My concern is that what this bill does is go beyond what the LCDC rule authorizes, as I understand it, and I haven't read this carefully. If it allows us to have authority that we already have, then we probably have no objection to the Dash 1 amendments. If it, on the other hand, says that Metro will use subregional analysis in each and every case, then that's the concern that I think we have, because MPAC, again, chaired by Hillsborough, and the subcommittee is chaired by Forest Grove on this issue. What I've been told is that there are cases where subregional would not make sense, or where local jurisdictions would not want to pursue that. And I can't give you examples of that, but I'll pursue it.
Okay, another question. Do you know why the city of Portland appealed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menace, I do not know why the city of Portland appealed. I was hoping that someone from the city would be here today to outline that issue.
I see Mark Landauer shaking his head.
He hasn't got a clue.
Right.
He represents.
We will tell Captain Klink.
Right.
Westland, are they here?
Yeah, Westland is not here, Mr. Chairman, but I do believe that Thousand Friends is here, and I was having a discussion in the hall, and I think they'd be able to tell you both what their objection is as well as city of Portland's.
Come on down.
Trying to help
I
here.
I see one friend of the thousand. Two.
Thank you very much. Could we have Mary Kyle McCurdy of Thousand Friends, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Corcoran and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, a staff attorney with 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I, too, have just received the Dash 1 amendments and just will have only a few things to say about them. We oppose this bill for several reasons. First, we don't believe the bill is necessary. As you just heard, LCDC did adopt a rule allowing Metro to do a subregional analysis of regional land needs. And yes, we have appealed that, but it's on one small ground. The rule is a roadmap of how to read Goal 14 and existing statutes together, and we think it just left out one thing. Even if we win, it does not stop the subregional rule from going into effect. And as I understand, that's the same concern the city of Portland has. But I would like to add...
Mr. Chairman, why not fix it right here? Why leave everything in the courts and muck around with the court stuff? Why not just fix it?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menace, I don't believe the bill before you fixes it. I think
But we can. That's the point, I guess. Couldn't you come to the table and fix it? I mean, we're the people's representatives. Right. We represent the interests of the people, not your interests or the city of Portland or anybody else's. The aggregate, we think, anyway.
I don't think it requires legislation to fix it. It has to do with how to read an administrative rule in an existing state statute together.
Where do administrative rules come from?
LCDC's administrative rules.
Well, where do they come from?
Well, they come from the statutory authority granted to
exactly.
LCDC. Yes,
that's what we create statutes.
Right, I understand
why not
that.
Fix it?
Senator Corcoran, Chair Corcoran, Senator Menace, we could look into that. I think that's quite a different bill than this is. And, in fact, we may be able to fix it just with the Attorney General in the course of the brief. I think that might actually be faster.
Mr. Again, I don't understand why a bunch of lawyers want to sit around unless they have an interest in getting paid or something, but why not sit at a table and see if you can't get the parties to come to a resolution here rather than spending time in front of a court and briefing the case and arguing ad nauseum. Why not fix it here?
Could you, I guess it does occur to me that if it was a very narrow objection, can you state that objection?
Chair Corcoran, it will only make sense to land use wonks, but it has to do with the statute regarding Goal 2, and Goal 14, and 197, 298, and how those are read together. And essentially, the current rule now says that if there's a need identified, industrial land, housing land, whatever, that Metro can go immediately to looking at that on a sub-regional basis and look only within one sub-region to meet that need or to see if that need can be met there. We believe Goal 14 and the Goal 2 statute and rule both require that first Metro has to look within the entire UTV to see if that need can be met. Now, if that's a need that has particular local characteristics, then they can go to that locality. But first they have to examine whether that need can be met in the existing urban growth boundaries in entirety. I would like to add, through the process of adopting the subregional rule, it was an intensive, long process with lots of parties negotiating, and we've come to a rule that all of us could hold hands on and say, yes, this is correct. This is a good roadmap. It puts parameters on how Metro analyzes subregional need. And I'm afraid that those things will unravel and potentially delay the use of this even longer. I think that the bill is currently written, and including with the Dash 1 amendments, is too broad and it's mandatory. Unlike the administrative rule, this bill mandates Metro to conduct a subregional analysis regardless of whether there's an underlying policy basis to do so. In contrast, LCDC's rule requires Metro to first prove that there's a sound land use planning reason to conduct a subregional analysis and to expand the UGB. The Portland metropolitan region, which is really an area even larger than Metro's jurisdiction, functions for many things as one region: transportation, housing, employment. It's a complex system. And to require a subregional approach in the absence of showing need, we think, would be a parochial action contrary to how Metro functions and the metropolitan region functions. We recommend the legislature first let Metro use the existing rule and see if it works, and if not, then come back and amend the rule or amend a statute. We believe the bill will also most likely result in farmland being unnecessarily added to the UGB. This bill will be used, among other things, to justify bringing farmland into the UGB in Washington County in order to provide housing for Washington County's job base. However, every academic study, and I've included a few in my submission to you, has shown that the reasons people choose to live where they do are quite varied, and the proximity of current employment to only one person in a household plays a small part in that decision of where to choose to live. Other factors that are more prevalent include quality of schools, proximity to nature or other cultural or other venues, housing affordability, proximity to all workers in the household, and the fact that the average worker in the United States changes jobs every 2 years and does not change housing each time. These studies have shown that attempts in other places to balance jobs and housing has had no impact on transportation system congestion or patterns. And just a couple of things on the Dash 1 amendments. They're not a codification of the rule, and I can point that out in later testimony. They're quite different. And secondly, there was a lot of discussion at Metro about tax-based issues, and again, quite a few academic studies, as well as the conclusion there that land use was not a good way to address tax-based issues. Thank you.
Land use is not a good way to address tax-based issues. But Senator Starr makes a good point that the process can have the impact, since it's a larger geographic area than the towns that are included in it, of creating winners and losers in terms of tax base by decisions that they make to expand the urban growth boundary.
Chair Corcoran, and I think that's one of the things that will be addressed at when Metro uses the subregional rule. They're just beginning that work now to determine what sort of things should they analyze in terms of applying the subregional rule. And I think that will be looked at. Whether it's just at Cornelius Forest Grove level, I think is another question, but that is one of the issues they will be looking at.
I guess I'm getting back to Senator Starr's opening statement was, in essence, that he was attempting to codify the rule. Whether, you know, it does, in fact, do that or not, it's an open question. I certainly don't know the answer
But if that was his intent, and if your objection and the city of mm-hmm. Portland's objection mm-hmm. was very narrow, I don't understand. And we have testimony that Metro will probably be sustained on this, which is, I guess, an open question. It would seem like you're not that far away from a language resolution.
Senator Corcoran, this bill does not resemble the rule, and I'd be happy to provide testimony comparing the Dash 1 amendments to the rule, but none of the original bill nor the Dash 1 amendments resemble the rule that was adopted. Okay. You could change it to incorporate that language altogether with my one change. That is a possibility, but that's not in this bill at the moment.
Senator Starr?
Well, when the request is made of council, and all of us just got this right before the hearing started,
right.
So nobody has a chance to really to look at it or read it. My request to council was to draft an amendment to the bill to codify the rule.
Okay.
And so that was the request. Now, we can say that, I mean, we'll all mm-hmm. have a chance to look at it and read it. Then if it doesn't, we can amend it so it does.
Is the drafter in the room?
No.
Oh.
Senator, sir, I respect that that's what you asked. I have no doubt. This is just not the same process as was laid out in the rule. And
Chris, are you the drafter then? Do you want to come up and speak to us?
Actually, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I guess to me the better question is whether or not the parties are willing to sit down and discuss the issue and negotiate something. It seems to me that this is an opportune time to try to find a resolution. But it seems like that's possible, isn't it?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, it may be. It just depends on, this bill is pretty far away from the existing rule, so we need to get together and figure out.
Talk about the problem. If there's a problem, Senator Starr's brought a problem right. to the committee. If it can be resolved, why not resolve it?
Well, I don't have the rule in front of me, the administrative rule that was adopted by LCDC, right. but at least two things that are new to state law and as well as to that rule states that the buildable land supply shall be at least 20 years. The words at least are new to state law. It's been an up to 20-year land supply.
But Mr. Chairman, are you willing to work in a work group with Senator Starr?
Senator Miss, certainly.
Sounds like a deal to me.
Well, the only obstacle would be John Chandler and his effervescent personality, but
he's
he's a lawyer too, I know. Yeah. We could even put him in.
He sings good.
It's your bill, Senator Starr. I think from the sounds of it, I mean, if your instruction to legislative council was to codify the rule, and then it sounds like there's a dispute between 1,000 friends and Chris over whether that in fact got done or not, so we could have that discussion. And if the objection to the Metro sub-regional question was very mm-hmm. Minor or very concise, mm-hmm. then it seems to me that we could give you a little time to try to work it out.
We could save the city of Portland some money on litigation.
Yeah, that's right. They could afford to have Landauer go to hearings and actually know what the city was objecting to. What the hell? It's all kinds of a win-win. Thank you very much. I think that makes sense to me. Senator Starr shaking his head. Mr. Chandler, you want to come up and testify? Shed a little light on this issue?
Oh, yeah. don't start obfuscating things either.
Yeah. Chandler, obfuscate?
Say something clear.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, legislative advocates here on behalf of the Home Builders Association, the Oregon Building Industry Association, and the Urban Developers Coalition. Supporting Senate Bill 763 with some this trepidation and concerns you've all heard already about the Dash 1 amendments there too. We have been in favor of sub-regional analysis for many, many years, we think, in the metro area and frankly perhaps even in Eugene area, that having some way to look at a large geographic area that has disparate needs and disparate parts of the community makes an awful lot of sense. And since this is just limited to metro, I'll confine my remarks there. I think that it's an excellent idea to try to force that issue forward and make sure that it happens. If there's a work group established, I'd be more than happy to be a part of it if that would be helpful.
Sounds good to me. Okay. Any questions? Hearing none. Thank you, Mr. Chandler. All right, we'll close the public hearing and look forward to the work group, and Senator Starr will keep us apprised as to where we move next on it.
Great, thank you.
With that, we're adjourned. Oh, excuse me, please. I'm going to tap in one bill here.
71.
Yes, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 571. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 571. We're adjourned.
Make sure the record shows you didn't adjourn first.
I didn't adjourn first. I was just kidding. Now we're adjourned.